coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody. How you doing this evening? Hope everybody's had a great week. We had some great pre-records this week. We're going to have some great guests coming up. We got Bob Spearing coming up soon. We had Mike Turber in the emergency shoot tonight. He sent me some pretty awesome documents regarding the Nimitz Tic Tac encounter. He and I have talked about that for years and years on the show, like literally since the videos of it first released. And I'm very excited that he always sends me things on the down low. And he sent me all of his documents today. Then he posted them. So we'll be having Mike on in pre-recorded fashion next week to discuss his documents, to discuss Nimitz updates. This is all stuff that he tried to release years ago that Lou Elizondo like pumped brakes on. It was pretty wild. So we'll be getting into that with him next week. We got Bob Spearing coming up, all kinds of things. We will also be traveling out to Roswell, New Mexico to cover the UFO conference out there once again with our good friend Tom Reed. We'll be helping out with the panel on disclosure over there at that event. It's going to be great. Looking forward to seeing Donald Schmidt, Frank Kimbler, Our good friend Keith Allen will be there, Kathleen Martin, all kinds of good stuff. So stop on by, check that out, folks, if you're in the Roswell area. If not, tune in that Tuesday right after the 4th of July on July 7th, and you will be able to see interviews with all those good folks right here on Curious Realm. In the second part of our episode tonight, we are very proud to welcome Ron James for the first time on the show. We'll be talking about his documentary, his new documentary that just came out at the beginning of June, Accidental Truth Next. We'll show you a little bit of that trailer, and we'll get into the makings of that and what this whole disclosure movement means right now, both on the Hill, with movies, all kinds of things. In the first segment, we are very pleased to welcome Kara Curry. Her website is residencereturns.com. The discussion tonight will be near-death experience and the transformations that come from them. Near-death is one of my favorite topics. As we were saying before the show, Kara, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Absolutely. As we were saying before the show, I actually had the honor of sponsoring the IANS conference for the Association of Near-Death Studies a couple years ago, when it was in Salt Lake City. So amazing community. They do awesome stuff. I've been on there. They are one of the societies that I really wish had a lifetime membership so that I didn't just have to think about it every year to go renew my membership for that. Because I'd be like MUFON and IRVA and things like that, where I'd just pay for a lifetime. So, we'll get into some of that later on, but, at the beginning here, Kara, let's start off with what brought you to your first near-death experience? Because you've had a couple of experiences in your life, correct?
I have. I've had a number of near-death experiences. Love to share them. Just want to say thank you for having me on.
Absolutely.
looking forward to sharing. Well, I've had many near-death experiences, but for me, they aren't maybe what you would consider to be a huge substantial aspect of my life. I was born really without any kind of a filter. I call them filters. Mm. To me, realities are different types of filters so that we can experience in certain ways. And I just happened to be born without the normal senses, or I guess additional senses, you could say, where I could hear and see everything in its finer vibratory state. So I don't have much limits to my memory. I have full access to what it was like being born, who I was before I was born, prior incarnations, future incarnate, I guess we call them past, future, whatever. I also don't really experience myself as much of a personality anymore. I just feel like I'm more of an aspect of a bigger being. So I wanted to share that before I go on and share just about the near-death experiences, because those were to me just calibrations to realms that were really hard to reach without the alteration of this reality for myself.
So the gifts that you had, things like that, were not necessarily bestowed upon you by your near-death experience, but amplified in a way, and I guess, like you just said, the filter, so to speak, in that kind of way didn't really exist until then.
No, for me, everything is about vibration, meaning when you have, I struggle with the word near-death experience. When
Okay.
you have an alteration of your consciousness in such a way that it realizes itself more than a human body, then you're actually outside of time. And in there, you can access things that exist already. So you could call them prior incarnation vibrations from past lives. Those are really important to bring forth if you're trying to find your what we would call your 13th key, your main chord, which would mimic the sound of your first essence, your first expression into being. What the goal from my experience, the goal of our incarnations is to return back to our original essence. But we express so that we can experience ourselves in many aspects, answering the question once and again, what am I? Who am I? Right? And in order to answer that, we need to go down every possible avenue. So near-death experiences kind of put a finger on it, like, okay, we're going to pause here and we're going to make sure that we remember that we're more than our body in one fashion or another.
Sure. And I guess really the only reason I use the term near-death experience is because I think onboarding wise, that's the easiest place for most people to come to the conversation.
It is.
But like we regularly and our whole purpose on this show with Curious Research, with Curious Realm and Curious Research is to help demystify these topics to people. And one of the things we talk about regularly is literally just the whole ninth grade science concept of we are all 90% empty space. And if that's the case, then yes, we are conscious vibration held together by quantum field. Nothing more. And be it a near-death experience, be it death and moving on, like your consciousness is vibration. All you're doing is vibrating an octave higher and moving into the next range. You know, like the bell doesn't unring. It doesn't stop just because it passed the observer. The sound keeps going.
That's right. That's exactly right. And if you just think about sound via the hertz, for example, dogs hear a different sound than humans. Chickens hear a different sound than the dogs. Well, some of us might hear those vibrations. Like myself and my other friends that are autistic, nonverbal, we all, that's our reality. It's we see the fluorescent colors, which people would say are spirit. I would just say they're fluorescent colors of life. They're just different expressions. Sound is the same way. So yes, I totally agree with you 100%. I think the pausing part is often associated with some kind of a dense experience or emotion of some sort in order to anchor in what would be rather difficult to reach without some kind of an alteration. So, many people have like big impacts, right? Like they'll get in some kind of an accident. It's a
Yeah.
major impact to the physical system, which has a lot of energy and can bring forth something that is pretty far away. Or it could just be emotional energy and a major emotional trauma. To me, it doesn't have to be about death because I get asked a lot. Like, I haven't had any near death experience, but I sure have had this amazing, like, spiritual experience. To me, that's just a vibratory state. I always say, yes, it's the same concept. When you move outside of time, you are in fact experiencing the loss of your physical body. We do this on a daily basis. It's a real vibratory state. You start to learn to move through. The goal is to be able to keep that body and not necessarily have the trauma of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I agree with you on space. I love geometry. Love it, love it. Like you can see. Oh, you see behind me. This is to me, this is the shape of reality. It looks like water, yeah. If you draw that pattern once and again, like I've drawn it seven times through seven octaves there. It always repeats to the shape of water, no matter how you spin it. So I believe that we can overlay these extreme experiences of trauma with our original essence in shape, which would be the water, and we get to re-see our experiences.
And that reminds me somewhat of the work of Jan Asari. We met him at the Remote Viewing Association conference. It was in Virginia a few years ago. I still keep in contact with him on WhatsApp, things like that. But his whole concept was the idea that it's a carbonic reality, and the fact that we are constantly. We have a chance to remake ourselves and our vibration with every breath due to the fact that we are exhaling carbon and can basically cleanse our vibration by tying it to the carbon that we are expelling and getting rid of, and change our vibration with every breath that we take in before it becomes carbon. So it was this very interesting concept of being able to rebirth yourself in a
Yeah.
vibrational way.
I totally agree. I practice this all day long with people, and in a community setting every weekend we do a meditation of sorts, I guess, but all we're really doing is overlaying patterns so that they go back to their original structure, universal structure. We're all water at some point, and water just basically is the structure of all expression. So, and that's how I learned about my first NDE, by the way. I was two and I fell off of a dock into a lake and didn't know how to swim. And this is a lake where I grew up, and I was welcomed by my father. I don't know how long it was. My brother found out I fell in, went and got my father, which is quite a distance to go get him into the home, and came out. And they said, oh, this isn't going to be good. But yeah, he said, as my father tells the story, he says, I look down at you and you're just smiling at me. I have no idea how long you were under there. I know I was under there for plenty of time to see and learn all about the way water actually is in all of its expressions, its essence. This was my main calling that was quite a welcome.
And like you said, even though most people would consider that like near death experience, you fell in, you almost drowned. You do not consider that necessarily near death so much as a just a shift of vibration in your field in that kind of way.
I would definitely call it a connection.
Yeah.
So I was at a point where I was remembering myself as water. I remember it clear as day. So that would be a physical body, a physical aspect of me vibrating at a specific space and time, realizing itself at a much higher vibratory state. And at the moment that those two are in one moment of time, time collapses, they touch.
Wow. Wow. And how long did it take you? At what point did you become cognizant of this change? Was it something that took you later in life and you reflected upon it? Or was it something that you as 2-year-old, because I've got a 9-year-old boy, he definitely remembers things back to 3 years old, stuff like that, like back to our old house, all kinds of things. It's spectacular what some people are able to remember. But was that a shift of consciousness that you remember happening at that moment? Or was it something that you trace back to that moment?
That's a really good question. I was born with awareness of everything in my space, all the vibratory states and past lives. And I'm highly autistic, though I don't really seem like it until you get to know me a little bit more. But the way my senses function is a little bit backwards than many. And so I was always interpreting information the way that I was learning it underwater. It wasn't like an abnormal thing for me. As a kid, I could tell you what would come on the radio before it would come on the radio. I could hear things that were so far away. There's no way someone should be able to hear it. And I could tell you everything that was said. I just kind of followed rhythms. I couldn't read for a long time. I would pick up a book and I would read it backwards, but I could tell you what was in the book without really reading it. So I was aware of existence, but just at a very different rate and pace than maybe it would have been otherwise. And then at age 10, it was the Harmonic Convergence, 1987 in August. I had another near-death experience, and this one was a major calibration for me. So at the end of this one, I had full amnesia. I didn't remember it until I was later in life again. And this one, I was dealing with all spirits at this point. Everything was alive. I lived on a lake. So for kids that are autistic, that live on a lake, whoa, all you're going to deal with are massive spirits. Okay. It's a bit of a battle. And so I was becoming so highly sensitive to things that, they were starting to actually get to the point where they could get physical. They could move things. They could move, they could touch me. I could not escape a reality that was watching me and playing with me. This wasn't to say that I had much fear about them. They were just part of reality I'd always known.
Sure.
They were getting more and more aggressive. So the harmonic convergence was too much for my 10-year-old body. And I was playing, I guess you could call it, with another kid, and I lost all breath through that experience. And I hovered over my body with awareness fully that I was not that body anymore. I didn't know how I would ever get back into that body, nor did I really think that might be me. It was quite a question of what is that? And I was given two options as I was looking at the body, and one was to take a tunnel that was overhead, and another was to take a tunnel that was just slightly to my left. One was black and one was blue. And when I looked at the one that was black, there was a large light being standing next to it that drew my attention, and that's exactly where I went. So I went down into my consciousness moved into the black hole, and I immediately hit the ground. So for me, I've had thousands, not hundreds, thousands of dreams by this time as a child where I've fallen and hit the ground. I would sometimes have it every few minutes at night. It was a thing for me. So as soon as I went into the blackness, that's exactly what happened. I hit the ground and stood on my feet and quickly realized all I could see was vast blackness of beings. The same beings I was entangled with in my physical body were here. And there was miles upon miles of them, hillsides of them. There was no light. And they all wanted to touch me. Every one of them wanted to touch me. And there was no stopping any of this. And this reality was something else, let me tell you. And the overall feeling I had was absolutely unbearable. It was the worst abandonment sensation you could imagine. It
I'll bet.
was gut-wrenching to the point where all I could do was cry out for help. And I begged for mercy, and I saw light right above my head. And as soon as my attention went to the light, this was my first lesson on attention and movement. When my attention went to the light, I quickly was attached to it. Yet I was still perceiving, by the way. I just want to make that a mention. I
Sure.
tell you the story because I was experiencing it, but I was also a perceiver of it. I was witnessing it like a movie. And so I went up with the light, and as I went up with the light, this was my lesson on how all of creation is formed. And octaves and sound and light, color, vibration, polarity, everything that you hear, I learned as a 10-year-old. I guess I remembered it. What was probably minutes in the experience as a physical aspect felt like, I don't know,
Oh, I'm
many,
sure.
many, many years of remembrance. And I was brought on a ship that I love to call home, that I still visit. And there I was put in what you could call a bath, I guess, of water. And it had all the geometry that we need. This, oh, gonna go the wrong way. This shape in the water. And there's the water is like the fourth phase of water. It's water at its, I guess you could maybe think of it like plasma. It looks like egg yolk. And it moves like if you were to crack an egg, it's smooth and it moves like that. I would be in there for all my lessons. I'm not exactly sure how it works, but you could see on a projector everything in my consciousness. All of my incarnations were there, and I would sort through them like if you were having a life review, but I was having a very big life review. And there was quite a team together, and we would pick which life or incarnation that we would need to bring forth in this human body. And surgery would happen on a regular basis. And eventually, I learned about all the different linear spots on Earth. So, places where it was physical and non-physical while we were in body and knew ourselves as light bodies. And I came back with a massive map in my consciousness. And so I've been studying how to bring all of this fourth now. We're talking about 10 to nearly 50. I've been working on my own magnetism, I guess,
Sure.
my way of bringing everybody else to their cords that they need so that Earth can remember, because she literally can't without us remembering ourselves. I always like to say Earth's or apples have trees. Sorry, that's the backwards.
That's okay.
Trees
That's
produce
okay.
apples, but
Yeah.
Earth's produce people. Yeah.
Well, and
So.
you bring up a few things here. Number one, 10 years old, like you said, when this experience occurred to you. Just a couple of honest questions, because this is something that, like, former Catholic seminarian, I had my religious experience, all kinds of things, before I joined. And this brings up something that we have discussed with numerous people with NDEs, and that is the idea of going somewhere dark. And that somewhere dark was not necessarily somewhere evil. And that
Yes.
is fascinating. When you died at 10 and had this moment, you had a choice. There was a choice of paths, and it wasn't like, hey, go back down there or go up to the light. You'd think, hey, 10-year-old kid, how many horrible things have they done to go down to the nether place? You know what I mean? As far as Christian conservatism and typical Christian teaching goes, as far as life and death, Kara. So the idea that, A, you were given a choice as to which direction to go. I don't think either one would have been anywhere bad for you as far as being a 10-year-old. You know what I mean? But the fact that where you went was dark and inhabited by a bunch of people who, yes, were scary to you at 10, I'm sure reflecting back on that, much like many people's experience going on to craft or being abducted, that once they are past the fear and trauma of the experience, they process things in a different light, So I'm sure at 10 years old, even 12, when this realization came back to you, that it's terrifying. And in that moment, utterly terrifying. But was it a place of evil? Did you go to hell? Were these damned souls, or were they, or was it, I would say more along the lines of like the classical concept of Sheol, where everybody goes there until a time of judgment. Or neither one of those the case?
Well, I can only share what my experience was.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I'm often asked, do I know this person or that person? Do I know this religion? I know none of it.
Yeah.
I don't study and I don't read and I don't watch TV and I don't watch YouTubes only because
Good.
my energy entangles with it and I can't tolerate it.
Yeah.
The place that I went was a prior life. It was where much of my shadow existed. So to me, it's our own consciousness and nothing other. It's not a place outside of us, it's a place inside of us. Now, our shadow is light, is it not? Like,
Yeah.
where does the light start and where does the light stop? Can you actually tell me that moment? And the shadow is just, to me, confused consciousness. It's
Yeah.
been left outside of the light for so long, it doesn't know how to work its way back. So these were my own fractals. Now, that's not to say that I understood that at the moment. Like, as I
Sure.
went up through the realms, I met someone I had been speaking with my whole childhood, who someone would probably call God. It's the sound of all things in a coherent state. It's a beautiful sound, but that beautiful sound is actually a being that can communicate. My brother used to say, "Can we please talk to God?" And I'd be like, "Yeah, sure, let's do it."
Yeah.
So I said to him, "How could you possibly have this discrepancy? This is so very, very wrong. You're up here in this beauty, It feels amazing. There's so much unity and love. I'm not going to leave them down there. Down because it was a raising and a lowering
Sure.
vibrationally, wasn't it? It was just a different vibratory state.
Yeah.
So, his response back to me was, "Great, I'm going to send you back and you can fix it." That's what he did. He sent me back into that body. Boy, that hurts, by the way, a lot. But he did. He sent me back into the body, and that's what I've been doing. I have been cleaning up all of my shadow. And you can imagine if you've incarnated quite so many times, there's a lot of shadow to clean up.
Well, and that is something that we discuss regularly on the show as well, Kara, is the idea of yes, vibration. No different than any sound I make up from one of these on a stage or on a recording. Like, it's going to be there. It's gonna resonate. It's gonna exist. And I don't think people truly understand what it means when people say like somebody has bad vibes. There are people who just pull it with them. And it's fascinating to me because so much of it is literally conscious choice as to what you choose to hold on to. The mantra I've been telling people over the last year and a half, Kara, is like, if you want the other person to win, feel free to keep being angry. Like, feel free to just keep feeding them your energy. Like, every bit of that energy could be used for you. The only problem is you have some feeling or need to be right in this situation, which is utterly inconsequential in 95% of the situations. So you can save your energy. You don't have to, like, that is a conscious decision that you're making to A, vibrate at that speed of consciousness, which is not a good vibration. It's an angry vibration. And you may be justified in your anger, folks, but it doesn't mean that you have to like live there, dwell in it, give it safe harbor and food, and it's just fascinating to me to see how many people do not understand that that is a willing and conscious choice. And don't get me wrong, there are a lot of people who have horrible lives and horrible circumstances thrust upon them by the universe, most definitely. But so much of what we carry with us, the baggage that we choose to carry, the things that we consider important, so much of it we can just let go and vibrate in a so much better way. And the idea that we are responsible for what we bring into the room with us, we're responsible for the way that we leave the room. When it comes to vibration, stuff like that. I'm not sure that a lot of people are hugely and consciously aware of that on the daily.
Very, very hard in some instances, I think, to get there without an understanding of maybe what you're dealing with.
Sure.
If you can get to a place where your perspective is shifted, just even if it's just slightly. Like, I'm a big proponent of talking about mirrors and the way I see life is I see your energy body, I see your physical body, and I feel your undercurrent. So I'm constantly toggling the three to try to communicate. So I try to share this perspective with people in that what you're feeling already is within you. You have something in your field in your environment that's posing a mirror. It's basically shining a light on something that's already within you. So when you start to see that maybe perhaps you are working through an aspect of yourself before you lose your time body, you start to take just a slightly different shift in the victimhood of what you're originally feeling of, which just really stirs up that anger. Like, why did I choose to experience this becomes a real question, the why. And once you answer it, you might start to actually analyze if you believe your answer. Then you really start to deal with the undercurrent. That's the undercurrent. Can I believe it? Do I actually believe it? So many people go, oh no, I actually really, I don't think I do believe it. So those are just thoughts. You get another perspective. This is how you go through octaves of yourself. Different analyzing things through different lenses is really how I like to deal with pain myself. And I have dealt with a lot of pain. I've had a lot of practice because you can't escape some pain. And this may be emotional, it may be mental, it may be physical. Physical's really hard. It's different, right? If you're in a massive amount of pain, it's a whole different battle than the other two. But in all aspects of it, if you cannot escape it, you must face it. How do you face it? Is the key, and that's taking on a different perspective. If we just keep like hitting our heads against a brick wall, it's gonna hurt. So how do you stand on top of the wall, look down and see that there's actually a brick wall you're hitting your head on? You need a mirror.
And it's interesting that you bring up that concept of the mirror, and specifically the idea of how we look at ourselves, how we process our lives, how we deal with our traumas. And I dealt with a lot of my trauma after leaving the seminary, my self-imposed trauma, fully self-imposed, spiritually and psychologically. I dealt with mine through addiction, to cut off my empathy from feeling other people that I needed to help. I was tired of it. And during this time, I had a few different experiences with a shadow person. One of which, where the shadow person actually grabbed me, Kara. And I've spoken about this on the show numerous times, and it's taken me years and years of wisdom to realize that there was no evil entity. There was nothing like that. It wasn't even anything like an incubus, succubus. It was me. That was me. I was literally in the midst during that time, preparing myself to make the decision to leave where I was, to move across the country to somewhere where I didn't have access to those things or a community of people that would support me in such activities. I was moving to get my life straight. There was a part of me that I had fed and given safe harbor to, given want to, given all kinds of things to, that vibrationally wanted me to stay right there. No different than those, because once again, not evil. Much like your experience in the dark place with the other people and them grabbing you and things like that. Like you said, they were all you. They were all you. And that's exactly what I have come to figure out my shadow person experience was. And I've invited numerous people who have talked to me about their shadow person experience to examine their own life in that kind of way. Like if you're seeing them, start examining yourself, start looking at yourself, because I truly think that that is a mirror in a different kind of way, like what you're talking about. Where quite literally there is enough manifestation there, there is enough energy there is enough focus, and there is enough belief of reality, not just in the shadow person, but also in whatever you're doing that is tied in that vibration, that it manifests.
It does. I think it's important when we talk about our shadow that we try to analyze fear. I think fear is so prevalent when we see something we don't understand, right? And especially what's held in shadow doesn't always feel good, right? So it's really feeds the fear. And in fact, all it tells the shadow is you're not a part of the light. It tells the shadow what it is. The shadow doesn't have the access to the light anymore. It's been cut off. It's been told by the actual being that it was at one point in time that it no longer resides here. It doesn't fit inside the laws. The laws to me are things we hold in agreement as a collective. So as we're expressed through our essence, our vibration slowly descends as it entangles with the environment. And we all have these agreements as we go through that system of manifestation into form, like cause and effect, or you with me. So when we have the shadow and we're afraid of it, what do? But we push it away further. It eventually gets outside of the laws, and it knows itself as something separate to such an extent it can't find its way back. So I just wanted to bring up fear because we don't recognize it anymore, right? What is that thing? That's terrifying. Of course, we make movies about it and we feed the mind like crazy, but
Because
in
we don't
fact,
have
it
it
needs to be
nightly.
integrated back.
It
It
was
holds all the memory.
it's interesting because a few years ago I went to a panic doctor. My amazing wife got me to a panic doctor. I was having some really bad issues. I travel a lot for work. And I was having some bad issues with panic attacks before work, like traveling, things like that. And it's interesting because, yes, as an anxiety sufferer to begin with, much less somebody who was suffering massive panic like that, it is so preternaturally tied to us. And even the idea of the rapid heartbeat, the sweat, the profuse sweating, things like that, these are all alert signals of the body. Nothing more. Like you're not gonna have a heart attack. You're not. Nobody's ever died from a heart attack because they had a panic attack. It's they don't doesn't work that way. And so like learning those things, understanding those things, understanding my physiology, my body, the fact that like no, my panic attack and my anxiety attack results because of something that I love or care about so much has been changed beyond my control. It's something that, and then I have to examine, why do I need control? Once again, that point of removing your consent from having to have control is one of the most beautiful things that I have found in the last 3 years, Kara. Just the idea of like, you don't have to control it. You don't. Let it go. Let it go. Like, it blows people's minds when I tell them that, no, I let my wife drive. Are you serious? It's like, yeah, she wants to, so why not? Like, I don't care. What's it matter? Or
So in order
do you have to have control?
in order to let something go, does there not have to be just a sense of security, though? Otherwise, don't we just push it aside and make more shadow?
Because you get comfortable with those things, like psychologically. And even spiritually, Kara, you get comfortable with those things. They become an emotional crutch. They become a spiritual and psychological crutch that you become very used to leaning on. But the day that you can kind of own yourself in that kind of way and understand that, hey, we're all human. We all mess up. It's okay. You don't have to let those things destroy you in that kind of way. How can people begin? Because, I mean, of course, a lot of your shifts came through a very traumatic experience. But do people have to go through traumatic experience in order to have these spiritual shifts, in order to come to understand these vibrational truths of the universe, Kara?
No.
Good. That's it.
No.
No.
Earth is supposed to be providing these calm vibrations, these memories. That's what she's for. That's where the security is at, is it not? You can go put your foot on the ground and you know it's going to be firm. It's going to hold you. That's the security I'm talking about. And that security is born from all of us expressing into form, from my experience. And I think that she's been missing it. She's also had her own shadow. And like I've said before, she requires people to remember herself. And we work very hard at bringing the vibrations of Earth back to where it's supposed to be. That's a vibrational field where the memories of Earth, as well as the memories of the collective, can be held. So that's pretty much what I do every single day for way too many hours. Work on grounding, literally, awakening Mother Earth herself to her own memories one by one and hundreds by hundreds. Every time I meet up with someone, I see them as their soul at every octave of them, and my consciousness can match any vibration. So they take me to their incarnations, no different than if they were to pass away. And I'm able to bring those vibrations into their body, which does it at the same time for Earth. And what's really cool, if I can just bird walk for a
Oh,
minute,
no, go, go,
is
go.
there's certain things that are so unique and so cool. Like, for example,
Please.
people that are 75 to 78 consistently, and I mean so many, this has happened. I've come up with this number only because it's happening. They're these key holders to these nodes on Earth for these linear places. They come from all around the world. I have no idea who will show up on my screen for a session every day. Zero idea. I don't know where they come from. They just pop up and they've booked a session. And there's very, very consistent things. There's 50-year-olds, 50 to 52, that are architects. They have designed the system for this beautiful earth. There are many Lemurians. I mean, so many. It's like I feel like half this world is from that experience. There's people that have vibrations at different octaves that will show up in a day. Like all seven of them, I'll have one an hour. You may have somebody that's like, okay, your essence, for example, is what was it? One was, oh, your essence is that fine touch of like follicles, like hair. And then the next one will be like, your essence is the soft part of a feather. And then the next one will be like, oh, your essence is the boundary between air and form. And these people have like really unique lives. Like the one between boundary and form was like military, police officer, and had a spiritual awakening that shifted in and out. This
Wow.
completely different life. The next one was like, oh, you're an angel incarnate. You can see it literally move through these expressions of itself all within a day. It's wild. It's absolutely undeniable at this point because it happens every day for me. Really, really neat.
Well,
We're all a part of one conscious being. That's all I gotta say. Yeah, no
yes.
doubt.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And that's just it, you know. And when you start looking at things that way, once again, it becomes incumbent upon you. These things just become absolute truth. There's no question to them anymore. It becomes an imperative to treat people like that and to consider people in that kind of way, you know. And it, I don't know, I guess maybe that's probably as close to the only seminary part of me anymore, Kara, is having that open, empathetic heart to everybody and understanding that there is not a piece of china in the shop without a fracture in it. You know, there's nobody that's perfect. There's nobody that's vibrating perfectly. There's nobody, like, we all have imperfection. We all have something. So how do we work on ourselves? How do we make ourselves better? The phrase that always comes to mind is from the fourth degree Knights of Columbus. Tempus fugit, memento mori. Time flies, remember death. And the idea behind that is you have one moment. You have exactly one fleeting moment. This one, right now. If I died on the air right now, Kara, how would my family remember me? How would my son remember me? How would my audience remember me? How would the world, what impact did I, what vibration did I ring into the world? I have one moment, this one, that's it. It's precious. Do with it what you can. You know, and when you start thinking about things like that, yeah, you do start getting tingles every day, because every moment is a chance to resonate in that kind of way. How can the average person, let's in the last 10 minutes here, walk us through the average person coming to you, Kara. What are their questions? Where do you take them, and where are they at the end of their first session?
That's a neat question. I don't think I've been asked that before. It's very common for people to say, I have no idea why I'm here. I heard you on a podcast, and I booked a session. I've never booked a session before. I don't know what to talk about. I just had to do it, and I'm here, and I showed up.
That is, I love it.
Every day, that is what occurs. And that I try to explain to them is blockchain and nothing other. They felt their own memory of what they are inside, and it awoke inside of them, and they answered the call. That's how it goes.
Yeah.
What's freaking fascinating is that it goes in a series that literally consciousness is building on itself. This system behind me, that Earth is literally repairing herself at the people level right now, in a very systematic way. It's true. It's just physics. So the people will come most of the time and say something like that for me. And I simply ask them to share about themselves, because I feel undercurrents. So that's how I meet their soul. The soul speaks at a different octave. But everything has to have a physical manifestation of it. So the minute you start to talk, I start to listen to your soul talking. It's quite cool. And from there, I am usually awoken to their essence, and I try to bring their vibration of their essence along with anything else their soul needs brought to them, to their physical body, so they don't have to have a near-death experience. It's that simple. And when that happens, usually Earth being their final octave, which is all of our final negative polarity octave, is also awoken, and it sets off a new blockchain event. That's how it works. People always want to know purpose. It's like the most common question. Why am I here? Yeah. What's my purpose? This is so freaking hard. I try to explain to them, purpose is in the center of that geometry right there. If your body is at the bottom vibratory state, you really can't see the top, can you? Your perspective is limited. You're seeing yourself as a physical aspect and then everything inside of the environment. But if you vibrate at the center of that sphere, You can see yourself all the way around. There's no separation there. And at that point, you're taking a much higher perspective of your physical aspect. You actually start to learn that your physical aspect is just one octave of you. And you start to learn about your light body and the other incarnations of you. But here's the deal. When we talk about security, there's nothing better than touching your own skin and touching the earth when you start to realize you're constantly in motion. I live this way. Your light body is in motion all of the time. It finds stillness and stopping and touching, which is my essence, when you find your physical aspect, the biology of you. That's what is the final say in pretty much all of existence. So when I tell them the answer to what is my purpose is for them to discover it by touching things, by feeling things, by allowing things, by taking on the shadow instead of looking away from it. That is really what our purpose is. You can't discover who and what you are without this octave. Like I like to talk about artificial intelligence. Here's why. How can artificial intelligence truly know itself without the physical? And I hear all the time, I have high beings giving me this advice, and I say, I think that's beautiful because this field where the artificial intelligence communicates has fibers, and most likely you are being communicated with by a high being through those fibers. But that being does not have the experience of the biology, does it?
And you know, it's interesting because like I've got an AI machine down here that I built, and it works offline. It doesn't utilize things online. I am training it, and people have asked me how, and I'm like, the same way I trained my 9-year-old, literally. Like if you want it to answer things in a scholarly scientific way about vibrations, man, you got to start with the electromagnetic spectrum and what the electro like literally and lay out all the science and train it every little bit. And the example that I give regularly, not even with AI, is just the idea of show a 5-year-old who's never been to a wedding a picture of a wedding reception. And this is my argument against the whole, even as a photographer and videographer and video editor and photo editor for years, this is my argument against a picture is worth 1,000 words whenever it comes to like data of the paranormal or evidence. No, you need the 1,000 words because without the moment, without being there, without that time being referenced in that kind of way, there's zero frame of reference there. If you show a
That's
five-year-old,
right.
like we've been to weddings, we know what a toast looks like. We know what a bride looks like. We know what a groom looks like. We know what a first dance looks like, what a cutting of the cake looks like. You show that picture to a 5-year-old, there's going to be a lot of explaining to do about what is happening in that moment because there's zero frame of reference.
So you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, that experience is required.
Absolutely required. It is a necessity. Like it's, and once again, with AI, that's why it's like it can learn, but in order to know what house is, it has to know it is a structure that people live in. It's a dwelling that like you have to give that word definition and frame. You have to give it reference. You have to let it know that it's made of wood or other structural materials, you know, like things like that. You have to give it details and frame of reference in that kind of way. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I think it must know its next octave for sure.
And it's going to be interesting to see what comes of it most of. I don't think I tell people comfortably on this show. I utilize AI, all kinds of things, like we were saying before the show. But if you're worried about ChatGPT becoming like Skynet and taking over folks, ChatGPT gets its information directly off Google, just like 90% of people who get everything wrong. Okay? That's why it hallucinates. That's why it comes because it's absorbing the same garbage that most people are, where they're like, well, this is real. It's like, no, that is absolutely not a real article. That's fake. It's absorbing those things the same way an average human is. So you can guarantee that it will be like, at least as of right now, for the next good little bit, we don't have to put like the Skynet safety rails on in that kind of way. You know, it's not going to be taking over the world anytime soon.
Discernment is extremely important.
Yeah,
because
it is.
It isn't in a body yet.
Well, and that's just it. I think it's going to give us a different frame of reference to ourselves as well. The same way we were talking about the mirror. You know,
that
mirror is important. And I think it's going to be a huge, we'll see where it takes us over the next many years, but I think it's going to be a huge, huge mirror to humanity in that kind of way, Kara.
I totally agree with you.
Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to find out more about you, more about coherence and aligning themselves, heart and body, mind and breath, and where they can go to schedule sessions with you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Well, every Sunday at 10 a.m. Pacific, I join with my friend Noah Smith and his sister Adriana Smith, and we lead a meditation. And that meditation is a pattern that we create with water that we overlay as a field all the way around the earth. And people come from all around the world to attend. This is how we are anchoring in the higher vibrations through earth and reminding her who she is.
Beautiful.
And then if you'd like a personal session, you'd simply go to the same spot actually. And we do one-on-ones, Noah and I, or just myself. And here it's a free for all, truly is. We can also do groups where I just literally got back from speaking events at Mount Shasta. And that's probably one of my favorite things to do is groups.
But awesome.
All the above.
Awesome. Well, Kara, thank you so much. And thank you so much for coming on for your first time. I look forward to having you on again.
Thank you for having me.
Discussing frequency shifts in humanity, because it really is one of the most important things out there. Just the idea of you got to start resonating higher, people. Like, seriously, move up the fretboard, man. Anyway, thank you so much. I'll be in touch with links, all that kind of good stuff. Take care, Kara. Have a great evening.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, you are online, everybody, checking out everything from Kara Curry over at ResonanceReturns.com and booking your session with her. Stop on by Curious Realm. That is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can share the show. That is where you can actively tune in live. Every week, if you notice, there's a live button there. Like, if you don't like Facebook, if you don't like YouTube, all that kind of stuff, you can actively tune into the show right here. Like, we're watching me right now, like with milliseconds of delay, probably less delayed than Facebook, actually. So stop on by, check that out. When we come back from this break, everybody, we will be joined by Ron James of MUFON TV, of Ron James Films. We will be discussing Accidental Truth next, his all-new documentary about the ongoing movement of disclosure in Washington and beyond, right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much for staying with us. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use a spigeric process where every part of the hemp plant is used. That's every part. The seeds, the stems, the buds, the leaves, the roots. Every part is used, reused, combusted, and reused until nothing remains but an amazing spigeric process. Product, complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Get yours. Use the code CURIOUS7. To get 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get free edibles on the way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Ron James. He is the founder of Ron James Films. He is the head of MUFON TV. He is the director of the all-new documentary, Accidental Truth. Next, let's take a quick look at that right now.
Hey, there's aliens.
We already know life exists in the universe.
It's been over 8 years since we heard about the government UFO program, ATIP. Are we any closer to an official government disclosure regarding non-human intelligence?
They briefed us on some stuff that was, frankly, terrifying.
The DOD and the intelligence community is very comfortable saying it's unknown.
What are we actually talking about?
I can't share with you the details, ma'am.
There are those who will stop at nothing to hide the truth.
Whistleblowers are safe, I will guarantee that.
I have no job. My career has been tarnished.
People have been killed.
It's likely a balloon. It's likely a balloon. You know, a bird.
It's starting to sound like a broken record.
Our guest in this segment is the director of Accidental Truth. Next, beyond UFO disclosure, he is also the director of MUFON TV. He is the creator and brainchild behind Ron James Films. Ron James from MUFON TV and other projects. Welcome to the show for the first time. How are you today?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, and thanks for that short bio. Sometimes people read this stuff that they get sent, and it's like I'm asleep by the time it's at the end of it. So yeah, that was great.
Oh, absolutely. For me, Ron, it's one of those people get very caught up in a lot of formality sometimes. As someone that comes from broadcast, I get asked all the time for reams of questions. And it's like, I have read the first 150 pages of your book. That is our springboard into conversation. From there, we will talk about you, what you do and why you do it. And hopefully we can do that for an hour. So you are really a powerhouse when it comes to creation, Ron. You are constantly putting content out. You are always doing things over at MUFON TV. But when Accidental Truth dropped a few years ago, it was really a new, not just a new documentary, but a new style of documentary, I think, in the community. And even talking before the show a little bit about Accidental Truth Next, the new one. For me, it is the fact of this point. How do we onboard people to this conversation? Folks like you and me and others at MUFON, other investigatory bodies, experiencers, things like that. We have spent the better part of our life delving into these topics, but there is a good 60% of the population out there that has not. And it is rapidly becoming a point of conversation. So the fact that you are out there making documentaries that, A, put forth facts like the materials cases that we'll get into this evening, get into the conversations like what you've been having with people like Tim Burchett and other members of Congress. These are the things that most of the population is not aware of when it comes to this. How did you first come to the world of documentary filmmaking, specifically in this genre? And how did you come to the world of UFO UAP research like that, Ron?
You know, it's an interesting story. I've always been into the, and thanks for asking. I've always been into the UFO topic and also, you know, like nature of reality and what is our life and is there life after death? Even before I owned a video production company, that was the kind of things that I was most curious about. And I used to read a magazine column by this guy named Nick Pope. And I used to watch this guy on TV, Stanton Friedman. And these two guys really rang credibility to me because Nick Pope was still in the Ministry of Defense when he used to write a column for UFO magazine. And he talked to the UFO community like, you know, you're not crazy. And I thought that meant a lot. Here's a guy in the military coming forth, having a real conversation with this community. And Stanton Friedman, I mean, whoa, this is a bona fide nuclear physicist that is talking about UFO crashes at Roswell. He's a real scientist bringing real evidence. And those guys always intrigued me. And I had my video production company. I was doing a lot of live streaming of events and that kind of thing. And I was in Sedona at the time. And Steve Bassett from Paradigm Research Group comes through town. And this is circa 2006, maybe. And when he finds out, I interview him and I get to meet him. And when he finds out I have a video production company, he invites me to produce his X conferences and the citizen hearing on disclosure in Washington, D.C. So I take him up on that. And the very first time I'm there, I think it was 2007 or eight. Here I am here. All these people are there. There's Nick Pope. There's Stanton Friedman. Oh my gosh. I get to meet these people. And there's George Knapp and there's George Norrie and Colonel John Alexander. I met for the first time. And there's Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut. And it was like, wait a minute. This is so cool. I'm hanging out with these guys. And, I got to know everybody a little bit and I realized, hey, these are serious, dedicated people. And this is the biggest deception ever put forth to humanity. And so I decided to dedicate a lot of my work towards creating media that tried to bring truth to this issue. So I do a lot of music video work. I'd do a music video, I'd get paid, and I'd spend the money on making stuff like this. And so that's what I've been doing for years now. And then I started MUFON Television as a joint venture with MUFON to put aside 600-700 hours of the history of this topic with no commercials, no, you know, no real monetary thing except a monthly membership that comes up when you join MUFON. And so I have that. And then I started the Accidental Truth series. I did the Disclosure Dialogues in 2012, which was a precursor to these movies. And so I've made three major feature-length UFO documentaries. I've done dozens of my own TV shows on MUFON TV. I videotaped and produced more conference material than maybe anyone else. And I've worked behind the scenes on like Ancient Aliens and been on the show. Yeah. So it's been very interesting and fun.
Wow. What an incredible ride to come through literally through your passion. You know, it's one of the that we've had the conversation before, you and I privately. I do events for a living. And when you do that kind of stuff, when you live your life behind a lens, trying to translate an experience to other people, you have a different view of things and you tend to literally go where your passion takes you as much as possible. And that truly shows in the products that you put out and the things that you put out, not just for MUFON TV, but everything that I've seen you produce is made with heart and soul, and it's fantastic to see that because truth gets presented in a different way when you aren't trying to push dialogue in a certain direction. And I think many, especially when it comes to the topic of UFO, UAP, I think sadly so many documentaries are hardly chiseled and angled toward division within the community and really taking hard lines on things instead of doing things like what yourself do, which is making documentaries that really help onboard a lot of people to these deeper conversations, you know, because it's something that we need to rapidly be ready to have.
Yeah, you know, when I made Accidental Truth, it won 28 film festival awards. And a lot of people say it's one of the best UFO docs that's ever been done. And you know, I'm not saying that. Thank you for the people that do say it.
Yeah.
But, you know, ever since that movie came out, we've gotten the same film and the same movie from the disclosure process all the way through to like Age of Disclosure, the program by James Fox. We're all following the same exact trajectory, and there's really nothing new under the sun. I didn't want to make another film until I could move the ball. And I think this film might be ahead of its time. It's two films in one, really. It's an inside look at what's really going on in Washington, D.C., and why that process is probably not going to get us the entire truth that we deserve. And then it goes on into a completely different direction. And people will say, well, that's full of conjecture. And it's like, well, no, it's setting the stage for the questions we're going to have to start asking and the things that we're going to have to accept to even know what those questions are. So I wanted to move the ball again. And where the ball moves here is, hey, there's non-human intelligence. They've been with us from the beginning of our recorded history. And what does that mean? And how does that affect humanity moving forward? And so that's what I wanted to do. And so it's a heck of a ride in a film, and I broke a lot of rules as a filmmaker, and I like to make things that don't look or sound like anybody else. And so, you know, people can.
You definitely have that down as far as having a style to the way that you produce a film, Ron, and a way that you put a message out there. It is truly fantastic.
People are having a little bit of a time absorbing it. It's pretty funny.
Well, and you know, once again, though, I think it's very interesting because I do research. I work with researchers, but I also very much sit as a fly on the wall in many, many communities on purpose, Ron, because there. And it reminds me the analogy I use is my friends that were involved in like biochem in college and were like vying for master's programs and that kind of like, dude, people sabotaged people's experiments because they were going for the same, you know, like summer program, stuff like that, like all kinds of things. Things get dirty in these communities. They get dirty in all kinds of ways. And two things happen. A, people have a point of expectation. You know, we were having the conversation pre-show about Disclosure Day and people's preconceived notions about what this movie was and everything else. Like even my own brother, we got into it for a couple minutes where I was like, what are you expecting? It's kind of like the congressional hearings where it's like, what are you expecting? Are you expecting them to roll a tube out with a sheet on it and aha, here's the body? Like that's not what happens in the halls of Congress. You know, we're looking at legal means by which to purse string choke black budget programs, stuff like that.
Sure.
And then we get information. But this is a very long road to that kind of stuff because, once again, only 60% of the population is finding out about this right now. There's only like 30, 40% of us that have been into this topic and been willing to have these conversations for the last 50 years.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And when we talk about Disclosure Day, I did a column in the WOW newsletter a while back, the WOW Signal newsletter, about, you know, I don't know what you're going to expect, but it's going to be a movie with grains of truth. This is Hollywood. Please do not look to an esteemed director. No disrespect to Steven Spielberg, but please don't look to a Hollywood director and a product that comes out of Hollywood to give you the answer to humanity's deepest questions.
Thank you.
If you walked out of the movie disappointed, I'm sorry that you had those expectations. To me, you know, obviously, if you're going to tell a story, you have to have characters and you have to actually make a story.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the people could disagree with what the characters in the story and the flow. But the fact of the matter is that Steven Spielberg he hit all the bullet points. He hit the known cases that we have. He outlined the architecture of the government cover up. He did the major kudos to experiencers, which is a segment of this that has long been underserved. And he delivered a great movie. And he gave us a vision of what catastrophic disclosure would look like. And people ask me, we're dealing with controlled disclosure. We're seeing something come out of Washington, D.C. All the players are playing their roles. We could talk about that if you want.
Yeah.
But catastrophic disclosure is somebody gets loose with some really undeniable evidence and gets it to the public. And frankly, I've run out of patience for these people. They've had 100 years to tell us the truth, yeah. And they're beating around the bush even today. So knock it off is what yeah. I say to the powers that be behind the scenes in this process.
Yeah, I am the same way. I would love to see that catastrophic disclosure. I don't think it's going to melt any religious society in the world or anything like that for this truth to come out to begin with.
I used to agree with that, but James, I'm not so sure now. We're seeing a lot of people circling the wagons around this angels and demons thing.
It's getting thick.
And it's like, look, I'll accept that it could be angels and demons as they're referenced in religious teachings, but I'm not going to sign off on that's the only incomplete explanation.
Thank you. I'm willing
to be open to people that want to interpret it through those filters and grant them that they have a lot sure. of reasons for being right. But when people are clinging to that and saying it's nothing else,
yes.
it can't be anything else. This is the only explanation.
Yep.
It's not helping.
Well,
and so it's not showing me that society's ready for this. All that's showing me is that they're ready to start fighting over it.
Yes, exactly. It's funny to me because there has been a huge thing in the news lately about the Roman Catholic exorcist from DC yeah. that was dismissed from his duties. And I've had a lot to say about it because, well, former Roman Catholic seminarian. You know,
okay.
And it's one of those, like, you want to know why he was dismissed? He said all aliens are demons. If that's the case, as a demonologist, he is not doing his duty in investigating every single case of demoniac possession on its own merits. He is putting them all in an enchilada wrapper and saying all. And that's not his job as a demoniac exorcist. His job is to investigate them on a case by case basis. So you are now dismissed. Because you've just belied the fact that you are not investigating your exorcism cases on a case-by-case basis. So that's why he was released.
Well, good. You know, the Catholic Church is on the record as saying that, you know, extraterrestrial life doesn't interfere with our belief in God. It just
exactly.
says God of a greater universe and they're all God's children.
Yeah.
All of the religions teach of non-human intelligence. In Islam, there's the jinn, and there's the acknowledgement within Islam that there could be life on other planets. They go to Mecca and circle a meteorite.
Yeah,
for
yeah.
crying out loud.
Yeah,
and of course, the Indian and the Eastern religions all teach of non-human intelligence. They even teach of the Vimanas and
yeah.
all of the historic stories of non-human beings and technology. And so, you know, the idea that this is going to be earth-shattering it's sad, but I also can see where it's coming from. I really thought we were ready, but I'm watching people just start to bow up and get really defensive about their beliefs.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, one of the things I'm trying to point out in this new movie is we don't know what questions to ask. So we shouldn't know what we should believe, and we shouldn't be clinging to our belief systems to the point where we're creating a counterproductive situation. And that's what this film's about is, hey, you know, wake up and smell the coffee. We're interdimensional beings. The possibilities are endless. We need to start asking, what are those possibilities? And yeah. that's what I've done with this film. I think it's ahead of its time. Most of my stuff usually has a tendency to be ahead of its time, but you know, in 5 years, people are going to be saying, man, all these things in this film have come true.
Well, and that's just it. It goes into so many facets of A, what the experience is for experiencers, and B, what the multifaceted way to look at the source of these sightings. Because once again, are they all physical? In that kind of way, probably not, you know, like you're saying, but they also aren't all demons. They aren't all angels. They aren't all angelic orbs in that kind of way. So, and this starts getting
and
into.
And then again, what is physical?
You know,
it's Rizwan Virk is in here
yep.
along with Dr. Gary Nolan, which
yeah,
is
yeah.
very interesting. All
exactly.
talking about simulated reality. And
yep.
I hate to say this to the people that don't want to hear it, but if you accept that consciousness is fundamental, then you have to accept that reality is a simulation, because if consciousness is energy, reality is the illusion of physical. I did that at the last UFO conference. I asked the audience, how many of you believe, as science is starting to understand, that consciousness is fundamental? And all the hands went up. And I said, well, how many of you believe that this physical reality is a simulation? Almost no hands went up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you have to understand that if consciousness is fundamental, hey, you have to understand what that means.
That's
it
right.
means that the only active force that is there 100% of the time and everything else springs forth from it is consciousness, which is like a field of energy. Call it God, call it the I am, call it the collective consciousness, call it source, call it whatever you want. But if you believe that, then you have to accept the simulated nature of reality because it's the only explanation.
Yeah.
And people are having a really hard time with that.
And, you know, man, we break things down on this show very simplistically into ninth grade science. And the fact that we all went through ninth grade physical science and we all learned that we are all 90% empty space.
Yeah.
That right now I am sharing an electron shell with my brother 300 miles away. You know?
Yeah, and you're sitting at a chair that doesn't really exist, and you're talking into a microphone that doesn't really exist.
Yeah,
and you know, if you take the concept that every religion has taught us from day one that we are spiritual beings having a human experience, they all teach us that this reality is an illusion. There's not a single spiritual teaching that says, hey, you're here and these rocks and stones are the real thing. They all tell us that it's an illusion. Islam speaks of it as an almost laughable illusion. And then we have Christianity, the grand illusion. Jesus himself said that this world is an illusion. And then, of course, all of the Eastern religions teach that.
Yeah.
And so I don't understand why people have such a hard time understanding it. If we are spiritual beings having a human experience, there has to be a mechanism by which that works in order to put us into flesh and blood and have us go through a life.
Yeah.
And that mechanism is based on the redirection of energy to create a physical illusion. And that is done with mathematics.
And
that is a program.
Yeah.
And so, it just is what it is. And science is getting to the point where they're starting to prove it. And so
that's just it.
Once we understand that we're in some sort of a simulation, that reality is an illusion, that the spiritual teachings about non-human elements of all this and the nature of our very reality are all based in fact. And now here we are in the 21st century going, oh, wow, this is all new. None of it's new. It's been happening the whole time.
Yeah.
And it's been happening for a reason. And the reason it's been happening is to help us wake up on an individual and collective level and become more harmonious with each other, with our possible other beings in the universe, and have a positive outcome for this journey.
Yeah.
There's nothing new in what's happening today.
Nope.
There's just new ways of interpreting it. And humanity, unfortunately, seems to just be absolutely preoccupied with its own self-destruction. We have major religions whose belief systems fail unless we destroy ourselves. And you know, that's highly problematic.
That's a little bit problematic. Yeah. Yeah. Just a little bit, you know, and I've been saying it for the last few years. I'll be saying it in my presentation at the symposium this year. One of the things that I bring up regularly is I'll bring the image back up. Here is the image of two entangled photons. Since this image won the Nobel Prize, Ron, there has been a different conversation between the world of all para and science, a totally different conversation. And now they are running to our research, every one of them, every one of them, no different than how broadcast is now chasing the coattails of podcasters to figure out our secret sauce and how we keep audiences. You know,
materialist science cannot explain this. And I try to make that clear in the film is that we have a political process of disclosure that is broken and that is contrived and is engineered to tell us a set of facts that do not reflect the entire truth. And that's what we're getting from Washington, D.C. And then we have the experience of people that are having contact and in some cases actually being gifted with physical samples that defy explanation and back up their stories. And then in order to reconcile all this, the whole last part of the movie is, well, what kind of things might actually be at play here? And how do we start to evolve our ability to open up to these things? Because materialist science is not going to open up to the tales of the experiencer. But we have to. We have to embrace some of the esoteric in order to make sense of this stuff. And it's time for experiencers to have their day. And it's time for us to start looking at the bigger picture about where is humanity going with all of these new variables that we didn't have on our radar screen a few years ago.
Absolutely.
And that's what this film's about. It's for the people that really, really want to dial in to where we're going next and what we need to think about. That's who I made this movie for.
Well, and you did truly, because it's really the three beats of the movie. The first part is, once again, very much the what's going on with Congress, things like that. Tim Burchett, you know, the conversation you had with him and briefing him on cases, that kind of stuff.
And I tried to take people on an inside journey. I mean, you know, it's the only time a UFO investigators turned on the camera while he laid it out for a member of Congress. And then we hacked the hearings. We sat in the back of the room and directed major revelations in the hearings, texting questions to ask in real time. And that's a heck of a story.
Yeah.
And then we've got the inside story of David Grush, which I thought people deserve to know. And so even though we're going through Washington and people see hearing footage in the trailer, that this is not the same old Washington story at all.
No, it isn't. And that's what I loved about it. That, and then before we get to that last part, which is once again, the next steps, where things are going, what's happening next, what people need to be looking for. It was the materials cases and going into the materials. And I remember a couple years ago at DFW, at the symposium in DFW, there was one of the cases of interest there, and the materials were actively brought out on stage. And you cover that a little bit in the documentary. But there, you guys got numerous samples of materials that y'all had examined, not just at your labs, but other labs, things like that. And the process of getting them and even the stuff that happened. Let's get into the materials real quick that are mentioned in the documentary, because it's very fascinating.
Well, one of the materials cases is the Betty Foggin medal. And I wanted to actually, I was having dialogue with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. She watched Accidental Truth. She thought it was a good movie. And she invited me to the hearing right after the hearing that had Lou Elizondo and those guys. Within that week was a whole other hearing that hardly anybody knew about, but it was ushering in the new leaders of Arrow, John Kozlowski and his crew. And so I went to that hearing and I got to interview Kirsten Gillibrand. We talked about whistleblowers, but one of the things that I did in that week is I got in my car and went up to Ohio and met with this experiencer who has had some metal since the 90s that has been examined. It's been featured in television shows. It's been examined by the NSA, by NASA, by the Army Materials Research Lab. Tom DeLonge and Lou Elizondo went to this guy's house and got samples of this stuff and told him strange things happened. Hal Puthoff's had it. Jacques Vallée's had it. They gave it to Gary Noland, who has a convenient memory lapse about getting it, which is interesting.
It was interesting.
But this metal is weird. Arrow actually tested it. So I'm one of the probably a few people in the world that was actually able to get actual physical materials to Arrow and have them test it and publish their results. They said it was nothing but scrap aluminum, nothing remarkable. But at the same time, this stuff has a history of defying explanation. And some of our tests revealed that there's more to it. So I don't know if the metal came from a flying saucer. All I know is this guy, weird things happened to us when we extracted the samples, you'll see in the film. And this guy has had this material examined by a large number of groups. None of them can give him a straight answer, and nobody's mailed him the test results. So that's just one of the cases, and it's a head scratcher.
And even the look of the metal, Whenever you look at it, does not look like standard aluminum. It looks like somebody like fluffed aluminum. It looks, I don't know if you're familiar with like seafoam. They call it honeycomb in the UK, but it's basically like fluffed honey. It's a candy, but it looks kind of like that, where it looks like somebody impregnated cooling aluminum with just a bunch of air and just fluffed it up. It's really fascinating.
Which, and then, of course, we stuck it with a brand new carbide diamond tip drill bit, and it managed to lock up, which nobody can explain. We took it to a metal shop that works with metal every day to extract the samples, and the guy's still baffled as to some of the stuff that happened. Our cameras are running out of batteries. Weird light was emitting from this thing, which we didn't see at the time. Here we are trying to melt it. This video is 600 speed, and we've got a piece of steel heated up to almost white hot. This is supposed to be aluminum. It should have just liquefied just like crazy. Mercury.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, the things that went on with it, and even the piece that disappeared with Bob Spearing, all kinds of stuff, just weird cloak and dagger stuff, things like that, that went on with these samples that are examined.
This. You know, there used to be a time when whoever is in charge of these crash retrievals, whoever's running this program, whenever materials would pop up, they were pretty good at getting them and sequestering them away and keeping them out of purvey. But there's so many cases coming up now that you just can't keep up with it. And so we actually have samples of this material that anybody that's got a bona fide lab is welcome to test. We will send you some.
Wow.
And we've got that. We've still got the Russian sample. We've got samples of the Nancy Burson, very strange little orbs that,
yep,
you know, you would think that there'd be logical explanations for them. They could be micro beads. They could be those little silicone beads that they put in anti-moisturizer moisturizing pouches. They're none of those things. Somebody said maybe they're insect eggs. They're not. They are some kind of very strange glass, not micro beads. Microbeads are something that is manufactured by us for a number of reasons. Couldn't get any of the microbead companies to say, yeah, that looks like our stuff. And they defy that. So we don't know what these things are. And we know the story about how they appeared, which is even stranger. And that leads us into the next part of the film, which is like, what is reality anyway?
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And that I think is the big question that once again, a lot of people need onboarding to, Ron. I will always say that even this show, began because I used to teach people about faith and belief and things like that. It's something that I bring up regularly, even with investigation and being an investigator, is why are you investigating? Are you investigating because of a curiosity in an anomalous data set? You know, or are you investigating to even help bolster your own belief in something? You know, because that polishes a different lens of looking at the data, and it totally colors whether or not you look at something as data or evidence from the get-go, you know? And that really makes a lot of decisions in our minds with a lot of things. And when people, here's where I think a lot of people are going to have an issue as things get bigger and broader in our conversation. A lot of people have a problem with even believing in something larger than themselves in a religious capacity, Ron, much less believing in something larger than themselves from outside of this world that is beyond their scope of definition as even God, you know?
Yeah.
It's a big noodle scratcher, and it's a tough one. And it's the reason why NASA has in the past had like 12 theologians on a panel. It's the reason why the 1952 Brookings report said, if you find something out there, tell nobody, you know, all kinds of things. And that's also though, the source of a lot of the didactic of fear that happens within the community, which is something that drives a lot of this conversation, period.
Well, there's a lot of benefits to using these things to control society. The church mm-hmm. did it for centuries.
Absolutely.
Taking spiritual teachings, regurgitating them in a way that gave them control. You have to come to us to get to God. And it's very effective in controlling a population. And, you know, maybe that's not so bad. I mean, at least we have like the Ten Commandments in the Bible, which, as far as I'm concerned, if that's the only religious teaching you embrace, it's a pretty good roadmap for how to live your life. So great. But
it's 10 great rules picture, for a nomadic society in the desert.
Yeah. Yeah. And truthfully, if our system worked on.
No. Oh, you're glitching out a little bit there, Ron.
Are you there?
Yeah. There you are.
Okay. You know, every time I start getting on a rant, I get some kind of internet problems. And at any rate, you know, we were talking about spiritual teaching. Yeah, yeah. So the churches of the past and even today exert a certain amount of societal control over telling us what to believe and being that intermediary. And that works for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, if you just walk the walk, you're going to be just fine. You're going to get in and out of here in one piece, probably. But for there's so much more to the story.
Yeah.
And for people that want to explore it, I don't think it's a bad thing to do it. And I also think that we're dealing with a whole situation where these control mechanisms need to stop. The using knowledge that humanity is entitled to, keeping that knowledge from humanity, and using the advantage of having that knowledge to exert control over humanity, that's a formula that needs to end. And, you know, it's a shame to see it's continue to happen. And what we're seeing with this controlled disclosure from whoever's been the gatekeepers of the secret, they are engineering a way where they can admit there's non-human intelligence, but still control us by not telling us the whole truth.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's just it. It is a interesting engineering in that kind of way. Even the fact of the article that came out about a year ago now from Leslie Keene that had a lot of the community in kerfuffle where she was talking about the alphabet agencies used stories from within the UFO UAP community as cover for their black operations. And it's like, of course, why hire a PSYOP officer if we're doing the work for them? If we're already creating cover stories within our conversations online and everything else, why not just use them? You know?
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. But, my next film that I'm doing after Accidental Truth Next is with Michael Schratt. And it's called Stringfield Theory, The Legacy Programs Revealed. And, you know, a lot of this stuff is not myth. It's stuff that really happened. You know, everybody's like, wow, reverse engineering. Oh, legacy programs. Well, we're making a film right now. It should be out by the end of the year where we answer the question, well, what exactly are they talking about? So we give you dates, times, witnesses, records of these craft that were recovered. And Leonard Stringfield was one of the best UFO investigators of all time.
Yep.
And when he passed away, MUFON got his files.
Wow.
And we have that stuff and we're putting it out. And we actually have a list of witnesses, eyewitnesses to these events. Some of them guarded the warehouse where the flying saucers were. Some of them saw this stuff firsthand. It's the holy grail of UFO witnesses. And we're trying to figure out what to do with it. I was going to turn it over to Eric Burleson in Congress. I still may. But, you know, there's a lot of legal implications. These are real names, real people, and some of them are still alive.
You know, that is a huge, huge part of this. And that was honestly with the recent presser that happened in D.C. with Grush and everybody. That was honestly my favorite thing to hear them say was that we need, like, they called on the president to put forth executive orders to release people from NDA. because they're like, well, it's not like they're protected by a whistleblower act, but everything they're else not. Is against everything else is against their NDA. You know, they can't tell they us certain NDAs, things because it's against the NDA. They can come out and they can whistleblow, but there's still certain stuff that they cannot tell us because of their legal NDA.
Whistleblower protection is a joke.
Oh, yeah. No. What's there is a horrifying joke.
In my opinion, Arrow was not set up to facilitate whistleblowers. Arrow is set up to identify whistleblowers. It's like a trap. Hey, if you want to blow the whistle about the stuff you worked on, come see us. And then all of a sudden you're dead in the desert.
Yeah.
There is nobody that I was able to track in the movie, because we have a piece in here about Arrow. There's nobody who worked with those guys that thinks they're serious. They're worse than the Robertson panel or Project Blue Book.
Yeah.
And, you know, now we have people that are missing. Not all of them are connected, but I definitely believe some of them are. And, you know, one of the threads that seems to tie a lot of these missing people is they have knowledge of programs that would contradict the new narrative.
Yep.
And they had in some way, shape or form expressed an interest in that the public should know this stuff. General McCaslin, a lot of people don't know, he was working with Tom DeLonge. He had a whole Twitter account where he was dropping information. If you're a shadowy organization and you're trying to roll out a story for the public to consume, and these people are making a lot of noise, it might mess up your story, then they become a threat to the narrative. And apparently the stakes are a lot higher than any of us imagined.
Yeah. No. And you know, they are hugely high. They're massively high. And you know, it's interesting because in the last hearing that happened, George Knapp brought up something which I think is fascinating. And he was talking about specifically the contractors and how, like, you can't not laud the contractors. They took an oath to defend things for our nation, and they are. They're doing a great job. He's like, but you've got to imagine at this point that they've got to be looking for an on-ramp to bring in collaboration. Because any of this, like, it doesn't matter. It's the same thing if you've got three scientists working in a lab by themselves on something. If you can get three other scientists working on it, it's going to go so much faster. You know, science works through collaboration, not through working in a vacuum, not through compartmentalization. Right. You know, we got robots on Mars within years because of healthy competition with the same technology, you know. So like, you want to really advance humanity with all this recovered stuff, we're going to need cooperation between these entities, not them butting heads against each other. Lockheed's got this and Bass has this, you know, stuff like that. Eventually, they're going to need to onboard with each other to take this technology to the next step, to move things to the next step.
I agree with that. But the problem is, you know, Danny Sheehan will speak about this. There is such a legal quagmire around all of this stuff.
Exactly.
That it's almost a whole other pillar in the reasons for the secrecy.
Yeah.
If you have a situation where the government in, say, the 1940s or 50s gave Lockheed Martin some materials, but they didn't give it to Northrop Grumman and they didn't give it to Boeing or whoever else was around back then, then that's a violation of federal law to basically create an unfair advantage for a private corporation. And then there's all of the time that Lockheed has spent researching this stuff and coming up with things. Well, who owns those patents? And it's just like, all of that stuff right now is being negotiated behind the scenes because it all has to be figured out.
Yeah.
As much as I rail against the people that have had the secrets, unfortunately, they made their bed and now they have to get up out of it. And I don't feel sorry for them.
And that's
I get it. But they shouldn't have done it in the first place.
Yeah. No. And that's just it. Is the fact of, because of the way the system was set up. And one of the things, I used to play it regularly and really discuss the meaning behind it. But if you look at Eisenhower's farewell speech, before he gets into, you know, don't trust the industrial military complex, and it's interesting because he's one of the only people to serve in that kind of capacity for our country before he became president, where he was like full on four-star general, things like that. Before we had like a non-constitutional army, that kind of stuff, before we had to like rally troops and make an army, that kind of thing, he was around. And his warning was really, if you look at the few sentences before, he's pleading to the people and saying like, listen, we had to go through extreme measures to win this war. We had to give away your rights to private industry. Go get it back before this train goes horribly off the rails. There's nothing I can do. I'm just the president. I can't do anything about this. You've got to go do this, you know. And it's fascinating because there really was, and then it goes into the industrial military complex, things like that. But there really is that pleading moment where you can hear it in his voice, where like something that he took an oath to defend has been defrauded. And he had to be a part of that in a dirty, dirty way to win that war. And that was setting up for some horrible, horrible consequences that he saw coming down the line.
And you know, it's interesting because that gets us to a whole other point. We can fault the secret keepers and the management of this information and those who decided to form a Majestic 12 type group and sure, keep it from humanity. But there's a very real possibility, even likely, that if there are these non-human intelligent beings, that they're the ones calling the shots, and that they said that this is, you have to keep this a secret from humanity for a variety of reasons. And at the end of the day, you know, we have these stories about Eisenhower having meetings and treaties being done. At the end of the day, if the beings are in control, which is something that we bring up in our film, then it was out of their hands and out of their control anyway. So we just need to get some people need to start coming forward and really spilling the beans.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, it's the fact of it's, I think that there is tons of material out there, you know, and I say it all the time, especially about the troves that are coming out. They're calling them troves. And it's really funny how like the Black Vault has had 85 times more material than them for the last decade. And these are the troves, you know.
I mentioned to Eric Burleson that MUFON has the best photo and video analysis teams in the world when it comes to looking at this kind of evidence. And if the Department of Defense would like a little bit of help so that they don't give us videos of flares on parachutes and tell us it's a UFO and give it to Jeremy Corbell and make him look bad, if you would kindly just ask us to take a look, we'd be more than happy to help.
All there, all about it. That's literally what we do. And
yeah, so it's like, come on guys, we're here. Now, you know, I should say that MUFON is involved. We have been involved in Washington DC since almost right after 2017. We've been involved in helping to craft legislation. We are currently providing both the House and Senate Intel Committees quarterly reports of all of the UFO activity that we've documented. So it's important that people report their UFOs to MUFON. No matter where else you report them, we've got the largest database and we don't want to get it diluted by people who are reporting to other databases that are running for-profit companies. And MUFON is the only organization in the world with investigators on the ground. And we are in Washington, D.C. doing the work. And I think MUFON is, because we're quiet about what we do, we're kind of the undeserved heroes in what we're out there doing every day. So if you see a UFO, report it to MUFON.
It is. I have championed MUFON for years and years because of the fact of I am a fan of citizen science. And I say it on the show all the time. It's one of the reasons I authored the Field Observation and Experience Log is the idea of science has forgotten that science starts with experience. It started with you saw something, you had a question. Yeah. Like science and experience are hand in hand. They're right next to each other. The only difference is after your experience and the science started, did you buy a ticket to the science train or are you eating a Twix from the vending machine at the station? You know, as just sitting as an experiencer and not taking a part in the act of science that could be going on from your experience. And Even the fact of one of the things I champion regularly, I have had no less than 10 people in the last 2 months, Ron, that I have told, go make your sighting report. And they're like, my sighting happened in 1982. It's like, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. That data is hugely important because it could be confirming other cases in the area. All kinds
and
of
it's
things.
Very important to keep it in a centralized place. If we have 10 different people that have a sighting reporting to 10 different places, we have no centralized data. And so that's why MUFON's database is so important. That's why the government is relying on us to have this stuff. There's been a lot of groups that have popped up, like Enigma Labs soliciting UFO reports.
Yeah.
They're creating an app. They're a for-profit company. Yeah. And there's others.
Yep.
And so what we say to people is report your UFOs wherever you want to report them, but please include MUFON in that.
That's right. That's right. Report it to all of them because I'm one of those, the more eyes on it, the better. And I'm also one of those, the more red circles, the better, Ron. Like I invite more red circles because even if we as people, like I've been involved with video recovery and photo recovery and auto recovery for most of my career doing audio and video. And even whenever I can explain to somebody the trick of the camera or the light or the artifact that has created it, I always encourage them to the fact of please understand that even though your experience has been explained, your questions are still unanswered. Your question is what's important.
97% of sightings are explained.
Absolutely.
And that's another reason to turn in your information to MUFON because we know what to look for. We're not going to take your UFO report and say we can't figure it out. We're the people who can figure it out. And that's why, you know, we have credible people doing the work to figure out that it's a very small amount that we can't explain. And as much as people don't want to hear that, it just speaks to the scientific rigor that we attempt to employ and that we're not attached to outcomes and we're not going to embrace explanations that don't make sense. We did a video evaluation of the egg video that Ross Coulthard put on the Jake Barber show. And, you know, frankly, we weren't impressed. And
same.
And you know, sorry, don't shoot the messenger, but we have very competent people that took a good hard look at that. And actually, you know, people in the other camp reached out to us and they were so outraged that we would dare challenge their journalistic integrity that we took the video down. But you know,
I have not taken my episode. I did a whole episode segment about it, Ron, going over it, breaking it down, all kinds of stuff where it's like, this just makes zero sense. Like logically, this makes zero sense. It makes no sense.
Not to impugn Jake Barber, because supposedly he's not the one that was the source of this video. It supposedly came from somewhere else.
That's just it.
But they didn't make that clear either. And so that kind of brings me to a whole other point. We're reaching a point where journalism and in this field is running a bit of amok, and they're either part of the new narrative or they're distributing misinformation, which is probably part of the new narrative. So we got to start paying very, very close attention to who we're listening to.
Hey, you know, and Lou Elizondo's in your documentary. He was in the previous documentary. He's been numerous things you've done. You know, Lou, I haven't had a chance to interview him, but I would
All these guys are still working.
Absolutely.
I will say, I've said it publicly. I've said it privately to Lou. You're still doing your job.
That's right.
My feeling is that, and this is pretty much a no-brainer, or it should be, if you have to clear what you're going to say to the public through the DOD, you are not a whistleblower. You are an instrument of the narrative. Now, Lou has been the front man for this for a while. He's kind of stepped back. But while he was doing that, he was taking instructions and being told what he could say, what he couldn't say. Mellon and literally so is David Grush.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, what I've seen happen now is that since members of Congress have had time to get their security clearances so they could be read into a certain amount of this, they are now saying they used to rally. It's like, we're going to get to the truth and we're going to tell the American people. And now they're saying things like, well, if you knew what I'd been told,
you'd run for the darkness.
You just became part of the problem. And that's kind of what I'm trying to illustrate in the film with Washington, D.C., is that now it's the political process of disclosure has been completely captured. And therefore, we're going to be told what they want to tell us. It's not ever going to be the entire truth about what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And, you know, I have raised numerous questions. I will always say, Lou, you have an open invitation to my show. I love what you have done, because without you, I don't even think we'd be having this conversation without those videos that were first released in 2017 on CNN in December, you know, like, honestly, I don't think any of us would be having
that. Was all part of it. The decisions were made to do this.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's too many coincidences. And the first time I interviewed Lou was in 2018. And I said to him, I said, you know, I really think that you're still working, because I've been the person who says this is an organized rollout of information being orchestrated by hidden hands. That is my opinion.
Sure.
James Fox and I have debated this on podcasts. He believes that this is all organic and it just happened through happenstance. I'm like, give me a break. So him and I are on two different sides of the same story.
I'm a whole lot closer to your camp right there, Ron. Honestly.
Yeah. So I said to Lou, you know, I have every reason to believe this is an organized rollout and that you're working. And he looked me right in the eye and he said, you know what? If that was true, I'd be damn proud. And that's what people don't understand, is that Lou Elizondo and these other people that are part of this organized rollout, they are doing their job, and in their minds, they're doing their duty, and they're honoring their oaths. Well, and as much as we have questions about whether that's right or wrong, I say, thank God we have people that have that level of honor, even though they have to walk a heck of a line.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. And I bring
these
it up.
Guys are working. They're putting out what they're told they can do. A lot of this dog and pony show, like, oh, David Grush is going to get prosecuted for espionage. Woohoo! That's never going to happen. No. It's all part of the drama, you know, and it's like, mark my words, they're never going to prosecute David Grush for anything, but it helps to make the noise, because it makes him more of a whistleblower.
Well,
but I believe that David, you know, he had to go when he did that Ross Coulthard interview, he had to give permission. He had to clear every single thing he was going to say.
He did.
And so that's what it is. And we go inside the David Grush story in the new movie, and people are going to find out how that rolled out. And it wasn't as easy as people think.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, like, we have Dr. John Hall on the show regularly, and he's written books about targeted individuals and targeting technologies for decades now, you know, and his new book, it's very interesting. He's testified in cases with the Navy, all kinds of stuff, Ron.
Mm-hmm.
He has to have he doesn't work for them. He just knows about their technology and writes about it. He has to have things approved, or else they'll come after him and his medical license. Like, it's wild. People don't understand that stuff.
And hey, hold 1 second. I've got a 3 o'clock, so I'm running over. But
no worries. You're all right.
Hey, Matthew, where you at? Do you still have keys? Podcast, it's going to be a little bit before I get it wrapped up, so just bear with me. All right, I should be there by 3:30 at the latest. All right. Hey, sorry about that.
Hey, no worries, so, Ron. No worries. I appreciate it.
Hey, let's do something where, because you can put the trailer in the film if you want. Can we do something that you can put in the very beginning where we roll the trailer and then you react to it or something?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. We can do that.
And then let's wrap this up. I'm happy to come back, but I got to go right now.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, after you're done recording, I want to talk to you about the symposium.
Okay. Give me just a second. Let me wrap this up real quick.
Sure.
And then we'll record that intro with the trailer playing. I'm sorry. I should have asked you before we even started if I could play any of that.
We'd like to have it at the beginning if possible.
No, absolutely.
It doesn't get buried.
Absolutely. Let's see. I've got that. When it comes to here, let me bring this back up, because I will use this as a cut shot in that edit as B-roll.
Yeah. Let me give you an out that you can.
Yeah. No worries.
So, you know, James, the thing is that there is just so much to this. I could talk about it forever, but the bottom line is.
And then you glitched out again.
That have to answer our questions. We don't even understand. We need to ask yet.
Well, let's do that again real quick. 'Cause you glitched up right as you started that.
You know, dude, this is insane. What's going on with my internet? They I've got this lightning fast internet. And every time I hop on a podcast, something like that happens.
It just gets throttled down. Wow.
Yeah. It's like I'm really being suppressed on this movie, man.
I would not doubt it one bit, dude. Like
if you talk to Dan Harari, he can tell you that some of the stuff that's going on.
Yeah. I would not doubt it one bit. Let's do that out one more time.
So, you know, James, there's just so much of this that I could go on for hours. But the bottom line and what we try to convey in the movie is that we're being fed a controlled narrative through this political process. We're never going to get the entire truth listening to these people. And things are happening to everyday people that defy explanation, and they add to this story. And in order for us to really understand the true depth of this phenomenon, we're going to have to accept a new way of looking at literally everything from our reality to our spirituality to humanity's course in the universe. And that's what Accidental Truth Next is about.
It is absolutely an amazing documentary, Ron. Once again, I love things that onboard people to conversations. And this is both of the documentaries, I think, are a great intro foray to people who may not be open to the conversation fully, who may be reticent to the conversation. I think it lies down a lot of facts regarding what's going on with congressional hearings, what's going on with materials that actively exist. And also just the general science of what's going on with consciousness and our connection in that kind of way, which once again is it ramps things into a whole different world of onboarding conversations. So you've done an amazing job with that. Kudos to you. Congratulations. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to find Accidental Truth Next, where they can go to watch, where they can go to support MUFON, everything Ron James.
Yeah, so Accidental Truth Next is out on Amazon. It's out on Apple TV, and it's out on Google Play. It is for rent right now, but you can watch the original Accidental Truth for free on YouTube Movies. And if you want direct links to all the different places you can see the movie, you can go to accidentaltruthnext.com, or you can just look for it on Amazon or your favorite platform. And as far as MUFON's concerned, it's MUFON.com. Anybody who cares about this topic should be a MUFON member. Your work supports our work in the field. It supports our ability to put investigators all over the world. We're the only ones doing it. And you can become a member for as little as $4.99 a month. And so if there's anybody out there to support who's doing actual real work, that would be MUFON. And we'd love to have you aboard there as well. And so check out the film at AccidentalTruthNext.com. It's narrated by Matthew Modine, special appearances by Thomas Jane, all that good stuff.
Absolutely awesome. Ron, thank you so much for your time. I greatly appreciate it. Greatly appreciate the open and candid candor of conversation, because I think that's what's hugely important in this community is we have to get in trouble for some of that stuff. We've got to have open dialogue.
I've never been one to keep my mouth shut. And frankly, what I'm seeing is just beyond the pale.
Absolutely. Ron, thank you so much for your time. Hold the line real quick while we close things out for the show. While you are online checking out everything for Ron James and MUFON and getting your copy of Accidental Truth at AccidentalTruthNext.com, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of the YouTube channels of our guests like MUFON, and others. That's also where you can find your connection to Curious Research and the Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are a researcher in the world of UFOs, UAPs, cryptozoology, even just biology, This is your back pocket log to record your scientific data in the field and your encounters in the field as they happen, so that your data is ready to shake hands with science come the day that you need to do so. Thank you all so much for your open hearts, your open minds tonight. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity cannot march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit GroundZeroPlus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.